You're listening to the Midtown Church Sermon Podcast. Midtown Church is a family compelled by God's love to practice the way of Jesus together in Austin. Our big prayer is this: in Austin as it is in heaven. Learn more at midtownaustin.org.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's good to see you today. If I haven't had a chance to meet you yet, my name is Jake, and I'm just so glad that you're joining us this morning. So let's get real fast in this message. Sometimes God just doesn't do what we want him to do, right? I mean, and sometimes it's like, okay, well, you know, he can do it. But other times, like, it's a huge deal that he's not doing what we want him to do. Huge deal to us. Like something that you pray about. But God either seems like he doesn't answer, or he does answer and he doesn't answer the way you want him to. And, you know, the cancer doesn't go away. And he or she or you, you don't get better. And things just continue to worsen. Or another week passes without a job. And then another month passes, right? And you think, okay, God, what's going on? That will really, really stretch your faith, won't it? I mean, I found that very few things, maybe nothing, challenges my faith in God more than whenever he doesn't do what I really want him to do. Now, faith is a really big deal to God. Do y'all know that? Like, in Jesus' ministry, in the gospel accounts, there are two times when we're told that Jesus was amazed. Now, real quick, that's a big statement, right? I mean, if you're God the Son, and you're through whom everything was made, as John tells us in John chapter 1, like, it would take a lot to amaze you, you would think, right? Like, how do you amaze this guy? It's like, but I've made the universe, you know? But two times we're told that Jesus was amazed in the Gospels. The first time, we're told in Mark chapter 6, and what amazes Jesus is a lack of faith. Like, let me just read it says, Jesus is visiting his hometown. And when he's there, he says he could not do any miracles there except lay his hands on a few sick people and heal them, because he was, what's the word, amazed at their lack of faith. Second time that Jesus is amazed is found in Luke chapter 7. Here, Jesus is sent these messengers from this Roman centurion. And these messengers are there to plead on his behalf for Jesus to come and heal this Roman centurion's servant. And so Jesus actually starts heading that way. But then this centurion sends another messenger. And the messenger says to Jesus, hey, you don't have to actually come all the way to the house. I know that you have the authority just to heal from afar. And in response to that message, we're told in Luke chapter 7, verse 9, that when Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him. And turning to the crowd following him, he said, I tell you, I have not found such great faith, even in Israel. See, the way to amaze Jesus is by faith, either the lack of it or the greatness of it. Just to drill this home a little bit more. Faith is such a big deal to God that we're told in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, verse 6, that without faith, it's impossible to please God. Did you hear that? Impossible. That's a pretty big statement, isn't it? Without faith, it's impossible to please God. And yet, to come back to how I started, it's really hard to have faith that pleases God when God seems to refuse to do what will please us. When God won't do what we want him to do, he won't respond the way we're hoping he will respond. And yet, there are people whose faith in God remains steadfast even when God isn't doing what they want him to do. Do you know any people like that? You ever been around people like that? I have. I've had the pleasure and honor of being around people who have that kind of faith. And I'll tell you, they're like some of the most saint-like people I know. I mean, they're the people who, even when their world seems to be falling apart around them, they're not stoic. It's not like they're not affected by that. They don't grieve and mourn and cry and all of that stuff. And yet, in the midst of that, there's like a deep current of peace and hope. My sister Kaylee and my brother-in-law Sebastian are two of those people. 10 years ago, Kaylee and Sebastian had their very first child, a baby girl, and they named Annabelle. Annabelle lived for 5 months. She was born with a chromosomal disorder that led her to be born blind, underdeveloped lungs, and a number of other complications. And they spent all but 1 weekend in the ICU with her, in the NICU with her. They got to bring her home for 3 days, and then they were back. During that time, they prayed and they prayed and they prayed that God would heal their daughter and extend her life. But God didn't do what they were asking him to do. He didn't respond the way that they hoped that he would respond. Got a little mood music here. During that time, you would think and that their faith would just fall apart. I mean, that's the sign of your first baby dies. That's the kind of thing that caused you just to walk away from God, right? But instead, their faith in God remained steadfast, and I was amazed by it. And again, it's not like they didn't mourn and cry and spend sleepless nights in the NICU just weeping over their situation and over their daughter. They did, and they should, and it was good for them to do that. And yet, they didn't fall apart. How did they not fall apart when faced with that kind of tragedy? If they were here in the room with you, with us today, they would say this, and I know this with absolute confidence because they've said this to me and many other people many times over the last 10 years. They would say the reason they didn't fall apart, the thing that got them through during that time, was their faith in God. Their faith in God, the faith that God would keep his promises to them, that God was with them, that their baby girl was loved by God, and that when she passed away, that she was with the Father, that these things gave them a peace and a hope in the midst of the darkest of times. Friends, today we come to a passage in John chapter 4 as we continue our series through the book of John that we're calling Encountering with Jesus. And in the end of John chapter 4, we see this encounter that a desperate father has with Jesus. This father has a son that's deathly ill. And he comes to Jesus hoping that Jesus will heal his son, but Jesus does not respond the way that he wanted him to. And in this story, we have the opportunity to learn a lot about faith, about what it is, about what it looks like, and why we can have it even when God doesn't respond the way we hope he will. And so I really hope that you will lean in and that God will speak to you this morning so we can all have our faith strengthened or for our faith to grow. Because faith is a big deal to God. We honor God by having faith. But also because the only way that we're going to really make it through this broken world without falling apart is if we have faith in God that can give us peace and hope in the midst of dark times. So for God's sake and for your sake, let's turn to John chapter 4 and let him teach us a little bit about faith. Okay, we're going to be in John 4. We're going to pick up in verse 43, and I can read it for us. If you're able, I would invite you to stand for the reading of God's word. Let's look at this together. John chapter 4, verse 43 begins, "After the 2 days, he left for Galilee. Now Jesus himself had pointed out that a prophet has no honor in his own country. Then when he arrived in Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him. They had seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, for they also had been there. Once more, he visited Cana in Galilee, where he had turned the water into wine. And there was a certain royal official whose son lay sick at Capernaum. When this man heard that Jesus had arrived in Galilee from Judea, he went to him and he begged him to come and heal his son, who was close to death. Unless you people see signs and wonders, Jesus told him, you will never believe. The royal official said, sir, come down before my child dies. Go, Jesus replied, your son will live. The man took Jesus at his word and departed. And while he was still on the way, his servants met him with the news that his boy was living. And when he inquired as to the time when his son got better, they said to him, yesterday at 1 p.m, the fever left him. And then the father realized that this was the exact time at which Jesus had said to him, your son will live. And so he and his whole household believed. This was the second sign that Jesus performed after coming from Judea to Galilee. This is the word of the Lord. All right. So this passage begins with Jesus returning to his home region of Galilee, having been in Jerusalem, traveled through Samaria. That's where we've been the last 2 Sundays, right? And then now finally to Galilee. And there we're told he's welcomed by the crowds, people that had seen him performing miracles in Jerusalem. They're really glad that he's there with them. Now, it's interesting because here it says that Jesus in verse 44, that like there's no honor in your hometown, and yet he's welcomed by all these people. It seems like that seems like an honorable thing. All these people are excited to see him. They're welcomed by him. But here's the deal. These people, they were not interested in Jesus. They were just interested in what he could do for them. You know, they weren't looking to trust themselves to Jesus. They were just looking for a miracle, for Jesus to entertain them or to heal them, to impress them, to do something for them. But anyways, the news must have spread that Jesus was back in Galilee, because we're told that there's this man, this royal official in Capernaum, which was about 20 miles or so away from Cana. And he hears that Jesus is back. And this man, as we read, has a sick son who is deathly ill. And so in desperation, this father leaves the side of his dying son, and he heads off to Cana to try to find Jesus. In verse 47, we're told that he went to him and he begged him to come and heal his son who was close to death. Now, you know, before we keep moving, just think a little bit more about this man. Okay, we don't know a lot about him, but what we know is that he was a royal official. Like, most likely, he was a man of authority serving under King Herod Antipas, and that he was probably used to being in control, being able to get his way, to get things to happen that he wants to happen. But here, he is entirely helpless. desperate, unable to set things right. Son dying. So he does the best thing that he, and for that matter, that anyone can do. He goes to Jesus. But when he gets to Jesus, he begs for Jesus to come heal his son, but Jesus doesn't respond the way that he wanted Jesus to respond. What's Jesus say? Unless you people see signs and wonders, Jesus told him, you will never believe. What? Right? Like that is not the response that this father expected. It's not the response that any of us would expect to hear from Jesus either, right? It's like with Jesus, like if we're Jesus' PR agent, like we'd be like, Jesus, hey, let's back that one up a little bit. Like, I think you meant to say, yes, I'd be happy to go with you to heal your son, right? But like, look, what is this, you people? Now to understand, why Jesus responds this way, we have to remember what I said earlier about what was going on in Galilee. See, Jesus was growing in popularity, but only as a miracle worker. The crowds were not believing what he was saying. They were not accepting his word as truth. They just wanted to see another miracle. This is why he says, you people. Like, he's talking not just to this man, though, yes, to this man, but also to the crowds around him. You people just want to see signs and wonders. So they were happy to have Jesus do things for them to make their lives better, but they weren't interested in actually entrusting their lives to him. And so Jesus is antagonistic here, but not without purpose. See, initially, this desperate father knew very little about Jesus, perhaps had no understanding of who Jesus was, other than that he was a miracle worker, that he was able to do things like turn water into wine and to heal people, right? And so in his mind, Jesus was basically Gandalf or, you know, Dumbledore, right? He was a magician. He had this miraculous power, but that's all. In the passage, he never has any like real deferential language with Jesus. He doesn't call him rabbi or anything like that. Just sir. He seems like he does a very little knowledge of Jesus other than that he can do miracles. But Jesus wants his father, along with others, to really know who he is. And so he pushes against his father's request, but he does so as in a way to invite greater belief in him, into a belief that would result in more than just a son being saved from this illness, a belief that would enable this father and his son and his entire household to truly find life. So that's why Jesus responds the way he does. But of course, this desperate father, he doesn't understand any of that initially. And yet he's undeterred. He doesn't even respond to what Jesus said. He just says again, sir, come down before my child dies. This word child in the Greek is a tender word. It reads more literally, please come home before my little one dies. This time Jesus responds to his request by saying, go, your son will live. Now, because we know how the story ends, that seems like a really great response. But this is, again, not what the father was hoping to hear. We hear Jesus say, go, your son will live. And we think, yay, you know, Jesus is nice again. Way to go, Jesus. You got it right the second time. But this guy hears this and he thinks, that's not what I'm asking. Like, that's not what I want to hear from you. It's not a response I'm looking for you. I want you to come. Both times he'd ask, will you come with me? Will you come down and heal my son? Like, Jesus, will you go with me? Why is that such a big deal to him? That Jesus actually comes with him, comes down with him to heal his son. Well, it's because the idea that Jesus could heal his son from afar was unheard of. I mean, miracles are, you know, kind of hard to come by at all, right? But miracles from afar, like that really didn't happen. I mean, if this guy was familiar, he probably was. Most likely he was a Jew. He knew the Old Testament or the, you know, the law. He knew the prophets. He knew that God has used people to do miracles lots and lots of times, but almost all of those times, if not all of those times, it was done in their presence. Think about Elijah or Elisha, two of the greatest prophets in the Old Testament. They did a lot of miracles, but every time they were present with the person that they were healing. They were physically doing something to bring about the healing. This is a whole different category. That Jesus could just say, 20 miles out, go, your son will live, and the son would be healed. I mean, that's a godlike claim, right? For humans, if we want something to happen, we can say we want it to happen, but then we have to go and make it happen, right? Like right now, my kitchen is not clean. Krista's coming home, and I need the kitchen to be clean before she gets there. And I can say, kitchen, be clean, but unless I leave the stage, drive home, and go and start washing some dishes, nothing's going to happen, right? But in Genesis 1, we're told that when God created the heavens and the earth, he just spoke and it happened. Jesus and God through Jesus, according to John chapter 1, through whom all things were made, God speaks, let there be light, and there was light. His word was the action. That's what Jesus is claiming here. I can just say it and it's true. And this father, this desperate father, is now put in a position where he has to decide if he believes that's true. Can Jesus really just speak it and it be so? Can you put yourself in his shoes? How is this guy feeling? Like, my only hope was that there's this miracle worker that could perhaps come and heal my son. And I found him and I'm asking him to go with me to heal my son. My son who's dying. And he won't come with me. No, but he just says that my son's going to live. And what do I take him at his word? I mean, what if I go home? What if I start the long trek home 20 miles and I get there and my son isn't any better or he's worse? What do I do then? Amazingly. And I use that word on purpose, amazingly. We're told the man took Jesus at his word and departed. The man took Jesus at his word and departed. See, that's the most significant sentence in this entire story. It's the sentence that communicates what faith is, friends, and what faith looks like. I want to drill down on this for a second because I think that there is a lot of confusion around faith. So let's talk for a minute about what is faith. And let me begin by just saying what faith is not. First, faith is not a power that we can use to control God. The faith is not a force by which we can force God's hand. See, if you buy into that idea, it will really mess you up. Because sometimes God doesn't do what you want him to do. Even when you have big faith that he can do it. Just ask my sister and brother-in-law. See, faith isn't a power that forces God to do something, to act according to how you want him to act. Also, faith is not a belief that's based on a desire. Here's what I mean by that. Sometimes we talk about faith in that way. Like we say, man, I really want something to happen. So what do I need? I need to have faith, right? Like I really, really want this job. And so I just need to have faith that I will get the job. As if by our faith, we can manifest it into reality. That's not what biblical faith is. Biblical faith is not belief based on a desire. Instead, friends, here's what faith is. Faith is belief based on a promise. Belief based on a promise. See, there's a big difference between belief based on a desire and belief based on a promise. For example, if I was hanging out with Barry today and I was thinking, you know, I really like Barry. I would like to hang out with him more often. These are things I have thought before. And so I decided, you know, I really want to hang out with Barry more. You know, I'm going to go to Kirby Lane at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning and just really hope that he's going to show up. I have faith that he'll be there and we're going to get to hang out. That would be stupid, right? But if while I was hanging out with Barry today, Barry were to say, hey, let's hang out tomorrow. You want to meet me at Kirby Lane at 6 a.m.? Well, then I wouldn't be stupid to show up there tomorrow because I would be acting on faith based on a promise. And as long as Barry is not someone who has a reputation of standing people up at 6 a.m. in the morning, and having been in a huddle with Barry for 7 years that meets at 6 a.m., I can tell you he's a little spotty, but overall, he's there. Given that Barry is a man that keeps his word, I can have good faith or great confidence that we're going to get to hang out at 6 a.m. at Kirby Lane. Belief based on a promise. See, God is pleased. And Jesus is amazed when we act on faith that's based on his promise, his promises. And we can have confident faith in God's word because God is trustworthy, honest, faithful, loving, and good. That's what Jesus is wanting this man to realize. This is what he's inviting this desperate father to do, to have faith in him. And so he says, go, your son will live. And the man took Jesus at his word. That's what faith is. And the man took Jesus at his word. And he departed. And friends, that's what faith looks like. It's acting on the fact that you take Jesus at his word. And this man headed home. See, faith looks like entrusting yourself to Jesus' word and ceding control. To give you an example of this, let me just tell you a story that pastors have been using for well over 100 years. In the late 19th century, there was a very famous French tightrope walker named Charles Blondin. And he was famous for walking a tightrope across Niagara Falls, which he did not just once, but over 300 times throughout his career. All right. Now that's crazy enough, but he was so good at this that he kept adding tricks to his show. And just in case you think I'm making this up, let me quote to you from the Smithsonian Magazine. They say that in his most famous exploit, he carried, this is crazy, he carried a stove and utensils on his back. He walked to the center of the cable. He started a fire and he cooked an omelet. What? Like, I don't know. I've thought too much about that this week. I just can't imagine how you do that. But anyways, On another occasion, he walked across Niagara Falls with 200 pounds of weight in a wheelbarrow. I think I have a picture of that. After crossing over, he said to the crowds, "Hey, do you think that I could do this again on the way back?" Everyone said, "Yes." So do you think that I could do it actually with a person instead of this 200 pounds of weight? Everyone shouted, "Yes." Then he said, "Okay, can I get any volunteers?" Everyone said, "No." It's one thing to believe in your mind intellectually that he could do it. It would be an entire different thing to cede control and actually entrust yourself to this guy to do it. Jesus is looking for us to have that kind of faith in him. That's the kind of faith that he was inviting this guy into, this father. He was saying, I want you to cede control. I want you to entrust your life to me, even your son's life to me. I want you to really trust me, to have faith in me. My word, you can know I'm going to keep it. Will you really trust me? That's what he wanted from this man. Friends, this is what God wants from us. This is what Jesus invites from you. He wants you to really trust him. To really trust him. Today, in just kind of evangelical church, there is a lot of emphasis put on what was often referred to as saving faith. That when you put your faith in Jesus for the forgiveness of your sins, trusting that his death was for you, and then he died and he rose again, defeating death, and you put all of your trust in him to be the one who forgives you and reconciles you to God and brings you into the family of God to be with God forever. There's a lot of emphasis put on that, and rightly so. That is true, and it is the most glorious truth. And if you are here today and you have never trusted Jesus with your eternal destiny and your relationship with God, then my encouragement to you today is to do that based on his word. That what God tells us, that God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son, that whosoever believes in him, believes, should not perish but have everlasting life, that you would say, I believe that's true. I trust Jesus. You enter into family of God based on his word. That is a big deal. If you haven't ever done that, that's the first call. But for many of y'all, you've done that. You've trusted Jesus to reconcile you to God and to bring you into the family of God. But you have a really hard time trusting him with your money. Or trusting him with how to spend your time. Or trusting him with how to relate to the people in your life. You know, it seems like it's really easy, in a way, to trust God with our eternal destiny, but it's a lot harder to trust him with Monday or Tuesday. Jesus wants all of your trust. He wants you to cede all control. That you would say, okay, I can't make things right with God because of my sin. And so I trust you, Jesus, to pay for my sin and reconcile me to God. And I know that I can't make things right in this world. And I'm trying to figure life out, and I'm trying to find the best way to live and how to do life and how to handle money and how to handle my time and how to handle sex and how to handle whatever. And I can't figure it out on my own. So I'm going to cede all of that to you too, Jesus. I'm going to trust you with all of that. I'm going to trust what you have to say because you're good. And so what you say is good. And so I'm going to ask you to tell me what to do. Tell me how to live. I'm not going to put my security, find my security in how much money is in my bank account or whether I have a job or not. I'm not going to be unfaithful in caring about those things, but I'm just not going to place my weight there. No, I'm getting into the wheelbarrow, Jesus. I'm going to trust that what you say is true. And so I don't have to worry about what I'll eat or what I'll wear because I know the Father finds me valuable, even more valuable than the birds of the air, the flowers of the field. He takes care of those things too. And so I know I can take, he'll take care of me. And so I'm going to seek first his kingdom, his righteousness, and let him take care of all the rest. I can do that based on your word, Jesus. I believe, I trust you. Yes, with forever and with Monday. This is what Jesus is calling people to do. This is what he's inviting us to do. To cede control and to truly trust him. Of course, if we're going to really trust Jesus to that degree, we have to know that we know that we know that he's trustworthy. We have to know that he is worthy of our trust, of our faith, and he's good to his word. Well, this story ends pointing us to Jesus' trustworthiness. Here's what he says. Verse 51. While he was still on the way, his servants met him with the news that the boy was living. And when he inquired as to the time when his son got better, they said to him, "Yesterday at 1 PM, the fever left him." And then the father realized that this was the exact time of which, at which Jesus had said to him, "Your son will live." So he and his whole household believed. See, this story ends with the father getting confirmation that Jesus was worthy of his trust. That Jesus had kept his word and that he was powerful enough to do what he said and that he loved him enough to actually do it. He got all of the evidence he needed to know that Jesus was worthy of his faith. And so he believed, and so did his entire household. Friends, you and I also have evidence for Jesus' love and trustworthiness. In fact, I could argue that it's even better evidence than what this believing father had. For we're on the other side of the cross and the resurrection. See, this passage ends with John tagging on this line. This was the second sign that Jesus performed after coming from Judea to Galilee. And a sign in John is something pointing to a greater reality. What's the greater reality here? Well, it's that Jesus is able to save people from death and set everything right. Do you remember what the desperate father's request was? "Come down before my child dies." But Jesus doesn't go with him. And I'm sure on that long trip home, that father had to be thinking, why wouldn't he come down to save my son? But the truth is, friends, Jesus had come down. That he had come down from heaven, not just to save this son, but to save the world, to make the way for all of us to be saved. You see, it's because God the Father, our loving Father, sent his son to come down and die that Jesus can say to this desperate father, "Go, your son will live." In other words, Jesus can say, "Go, your son will live," because God the Father said, "Go, my son, and die." And Jesus willingly went. because he knew that through his death, he would end death. That through the breaking of his body, he would restore the brokenness in this world and in our hearts. And so he went. The Son came down and died. Because he did, we have the ultimate evidence that he is trustworthy, loving, and good, and worthy of our faith. See, even when we're facing incredibly difficult circumstances, even when Jesus isn't responding to our pleas or our prayers the way that we want him to, we can trust him because we can know that he loves us and he's all-powerful and he's good because of what he's done for us on the cross. And because of that confidence, then we can trust that he's going to stay true to his word, and that, friends, has the power to enable us to experience peace and hope, even in the hardest and darkest of circumstances. Friends, Jesus is trustworthy. You can take him at his word. My question for you this morning is, are you? And if not, will you? I want to really give you a minute to think about that. And so we're going to, as we take communion now and servers, you can begin passing out the elements. I want to give you a chance just to sit with this and to talk to God about it and to evaluate. Am I really trusting you? And if not, what's the holdup? And perhaps you might want to even tell him, Jesus, I'm going to take you at your word now. I'm going to take you at your word. I'm going to trust you. I believe you're trustworthy. So Jesus, God the Son, came down to die so that we can live. And while we were still in our sin, not taking God at his word, and instead going our own way, he laid down his life for us to reconcile us to God and to give us life to the full. Is he trustworthy? Friends, as you hold the bread and the cup in your hands now, may his body broken for you and his blood spilled for you loudly declare to you, yes, yes, he is trustworthy.
Thank you for listening to the Midtown Church Sermon Podcast. We invite you to practice the way of Jesus in Austin with us, because as we become more like Jesus, Austin will become more like heaven. Mm-hmm.